You were officially on with the president from 65 to 69.
January 20th, noon.
The country was getting upset and very angry with Vietnam.
Right.
So in the summer of 65, were you on with the president then when mm-hmm. the riots, the anti-war movement, right. and all that kind of thing came about? The summer riots broke out in most major cities after 65?
Well, 65 was, as I recall, the Watts riots. It spread a little bit, but it was mainly the Watts area of Los Angeles. The big ones that spread were basically after the Martin Luther King assassination in 68, and that affected Washington. It affected many different cities around the country. Joe Califano, actually, is sort of the ground central center for mobilizing our efforts against the city riots in both of those times.
Were you writing speeches for the president?
I didn't really write speeches. I edited speeches. In some cases, there was a lot of editing that had to go on and rewriting, particularly when we were on Air Force One or between stops and something he didn't like. So I would go back and do some rewriting. And then I coordinated the State of the Union speech of 68. We were all down at the ranch, and I did some editing on that. But that I recall, I don't think I ever wrote a speech from start to finish for him.
Did you hear him agonize about Vietnam? For instance, I have a quote here. In May of 64, he said, "I'll tell you, the more that I stayed awake last night thinking of this thing, the more I think of it. I don't know what in the hell it looks like to me. We're getting into another Korea. Just worries the hell out of me. Don't see what we ever hope to get out of where we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists are coming into it. I don't think we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home." Did you hear him talk like that?
I wasn't there at that time. I didn't come till February of 65. But yes, he agonized over Vietnam. And again, it goes back to him wanting to be viewed in history as a great president. Vietnam was something that he was not familiar with. He trusted Bob McNamara, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, CIA Director, FBI, National Security Council, etc. And without any negative votes, it was unanimous that all the decisions were made were recommended to the president. And really, his decisions were not a minority decision in favor of escalating or what have you. Bob McNamara was one of the most persuasive people I have ever known. He would come with his charts and graphs and statistics, and each time, I think he was the most persuasive in the decisions to escalate on Vietnam. Bill Westmoreland was encouraging the same thing when he was the chief in Vietnam. Finally, McNamara, in probably late 67, started having self-doubts. I think probably the last straw when he had the electronic fence, the virtual fence, so to speak, that also proved not to be successful against the Viet Cong. And he had lots of self-doubts. In fact, Lyndon Johnson, the reason he appointed McNamara, president of the World Bank, as the president told me, he thought he was going to be another Jim Forrestal and commit suicide, that he was that depressed over what's going on, the decisions that he had promulgated in Vietnam. And that's why he moved him out of Secretary of Defense, because he's very fond of McNamara, and brought in Clark Clifford, and Clark Clifford had a different perspective. It took him a little while to sort of express that perspective, but he did. Talking about the Chinese communist, we had intercepted some of the Chinese cables and what have you. And the one that was most persuasive, I recall reading, was after Vietnam, they were going to take Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, ultimately Indonesia, which was then the fifth largest country in the world. So the domino theory wasn't just something made out of whole cloth. It was something that, as a result of intercepting cables and intelligence gathering of the Chinese themselves and somewhat with the Soviets, gave the president a strong grounding that you had to draw the line somewhere, or all of Southeast Asia and South Asia would be in the communist hands. And, of course, that not only has a military significance, but it has an economic significance, because there are so many minerals in that part of the world that are fundamental to running an industrial economy like the U.S. But it was a great frustration to him, because everything we seemed to try didn't work. And as I have written, I think the main reason, he gave lots of different reasons for not running for re-election, but I think the main reason was that he felt if he was a candidate for re-election in 1968, that he would be so focused on politics and be somewhat reticent to make a bold decision on Vietnam that he might pass up an opportunity to get peace in Vietnam. And he really felt that if he could get peace in Vietnam before he left office, then history would look on his presidency very kindly because all the other accomplishments he had made. And I think that was the main motivation for not running for re-election.
But his own party was conflicted, split, and feuding about this. And a personal experience here in radio in Fargo, North Dakota, and WDAY, and Walter Mondale is next door in Minnesota, and so he would stop in. I had an afternoon talk show. He had just come back from Vietnam, and he declared then that he was against the Vietnam War. I'll never forget. I looked at him. I thought he was a traitor because he was one of the early ones to come out publicly against it.
Yeah.
And so the president sensed all these major figures in his own party were beginning to oppose the war. His support was falling apart.
As I used later when I was in Mexico, we lost that war not in Vietnam but in Washington. And we lost it in Washington because the perception is that we couldn't win it. And once you lose it in Washington, once you lose it in the United States, you know it's unwinnable. So in any kind of foreign action, you've got to have the public support, can't be deeply divided and be successful. And I think he recognized that.